title of this hour is The Struggle for Hope and Justice. Today, those of us in the village are being asked to give our attention to a day of remembrance and hope in the anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb. I think it accents for us the fact that as concerned Christians, we must always be within the struggle for hope and justice for this world which God loves, which God created. And I want to accent that word struggle today, not only in the title, but in the way that we try to understand the situation of brothers and sisters in Southern Africa. In the last decade or two, more than 3 million black South Africans have been forcibly removed from the place of their ancestry and moved onto mostly barren homelands or Bantustans, Bantu being the South African word for African. And we want to look at ways in which the church is both involved in the struggle and the other side of that, how in some ways the Christian church is part of the problem. That's part of the tragedy as well as the complexity. I think this day ought to be for us a reminder that as God's called people, we must never be silent when words are needed. And we must never despair of the importance and the effectiveness of words spoken by concerned people, both in the political sphere and in the sphere of the church. I think that inactivity on the part of North American Christians when brothers and sisters are crying would be and is a grievous sin, often a sin of omission in which we are not moved enough to move out of our sense of comfort and our own sense of personal peace to get involved in the struggle. I'd like to begin getting into this subject with a few personal images. The first of them is that my first visit to South Africa was the experience, if I were to put it in the psychological terms, of visiting a schizophrenic country. It is, on the one hand, very beautiful, and if one happens to be among the privileged with all the power and all the land and all the industry and all of everything that counts economically, it is indeed beautiful to go as a tourist. It's a fantastic place. The schizophrenia comes when you see that there is another South Africa. I illustrated that with a couple of magazines. One is the statement or the study by the South African Council of Churches and the Roman Catholic Bishops' Conference on relocations, on the forced removal of black people from so-called black spots, which are black areas in a designated white area. People often have lived there for 6-7 generations, have their cemeteries and their churches and their schools and homes and whatnot, but it is the decision of the government that is a white area and they are to be moved. And this took all of the financial resources, with a lot of help from overseas, for the churches to produce with very striking pictures of a people of dispossession. That's one South Africa, and This is one that I get in the office free of charge every month, called Panorama. And it comes from the South African Foreign Ministry. And I don't know how many millions of people get it around the world. It's produced not only in English, but in Afrikaans and in modern Dutch and French and German. And it's distributed widely throughout the so-called free world. And it presents a far different picture of South Africa. And every reference, it's a tourist type thing, as one might expect. It's slick and it's glossy and it's well done, and it costs millions. Part of it is that it also presents the situation of blacks or non-white people in the country always in such a very good light. Any pictures of nursery schools, that black children are all in nice clean uniforms, and it shows training programs of people being trained and educated. It gives a good propaganda of things that the government wants the rest of the world to see and to know. And it's an indication of a very highly widespread effort of propaganda that's going on through a wide variety of subterfuge organizations in this country, often reaching into the churches and certainly reaching into our government to give the story of South Africa that the government and that the establishment wants the rest of the world to hear. That's one vignette. I would think to explain or try to describe the country in terms other than psychological as schizophrenic, to use a more theological term, one could use the term demonic. And I think visiting with white friends and people within South Africa, they too are caught up in the demonic nature of the system. In many ways, things that seem to be good are used and made to be evil in sometimes very subtle ways. As I mentioned yesterday in the class, ethnicity to Africans is very important. Their tribal loyalties. And the South African establishment has made extremely good use of ethnicity and tribal loyalties as a way of dividing and conquering, a way of separating, a way of trying to develop the independence and the separateness of the peoples to avoid any movement toward unity or moving together of people. One time it struck me that the demonic nature of the country, going around Johannesburg, which is a beautiful city with modern gleaming buildings and nice boulevards and streets and parks and golf courses and hotels and all that ranks in beauty with any city in Europe or America, cleanliness. We all know who keeps it clean and who does the work, but it is that for the white people who live there. Johannesburg is home only for whites, some more than 1 million. The blacks who work there, who work in the mines and the factories, who work in the homes and the restaurants and the hotels and whatever, live out, as you are aware, I'm sure. Going around on the freeway around Johannesburg, you can see signs like we have here, the nice green ones that point with arrows to this avenue and that section, this section. Soweto, Southwest Township, one of the areas where blacks are allowed to live, is home for an estimated 1.5 million people. And as the freeway goes around near Soweto, there is no sign. There is no sign whatsoever that points to a city of 1.5 million. It doesn't exist. It's part of the invisible people, which the white government has made the rest of the country, the rest of the established part of the country, to believe that it's there somewhere, but it's out there, it's unknown. And I had made a comment to one of the members of the South African Council of Churches after being there for some days about the situation, and he said, well, you have seen in 5 days more of the life of black people in this country than 85% of people who have lived their whole life from birth to death in Johannesburg. And that invisibility is prevalent everywhere and is maintained, and to me it's demonic. It was in one of the homelands, or the Bantustans, near the Johannesburg Pretoria industrial complex. And out in the homeland is the housing for blacks and the laborers who come by bus. All of the roads are well paved, well maintained to the edge of the homeland, and never in, because there's no need to develop the life of the people. Their only usefulness is part of the industrial machinery of being workers. So you provide good roads, both for military security and for the ease of moving laborers into the industrial complexes. The industrial complexes are not in the homelands, because that would give some economic viability to the homeland. They're in the white area, but the workers are in the homeland, and you move one to the other daily. In the settlements of the homelands, there are some pleasant homes, and it gradually and quickly gets down to where there is no sewage, no water, no electricity, and shantytown dwellings. I was with one black pastor who maintained the humor of the visit when I was feeling the gnawing and the gut-wrenching of it, smiling and laughing and talking about it, while at the same time knowing his pathos. And one of the houses was made out of an old packing crate from the port in which an automobile had come. And it's a kind of packing crate that they knock down and either rebuild or send back for reshipment. And on it was stenciled the letters, "Knock down flat," which was used in an ironic way of people using it for a house, saying, "We will not be knocked down flat." I think of an image a couple of weeks ago at our global mission event in Roanoke, Virginia, in which Alan Bosak, Reverend Alan, Dr. Alan Bosak, was the speaker, president of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches, campus pastor in the Cape Town area, the vice president of the South African Council of Churches, one of the leading spokespersons of the struggle. A couple of his books are in our bookstore here at the village. And listening to him speaking about the situation, not only, again, with the immense problems, but also speaking with hope. And it was clear from the beginning of his time at our event that he could not stay for the whole length of time, because he had to get back home to attend funerals for friends of his who had been killed by police during that week. And most of those that have been killed during these recent months have been the young, often teenagers, school children in many cases. I remember another vignette of not too many months ago, of being with a number of concerned church people in New York City, related to Africa, concerns of our various churches, and meeting with Bishop Desmond Tutu on the day he was, day before he was going to visit with President Reagan. And the session of talking with him and hearing his perceptions of what he hoped might be accomplished and what he might do eventually turned into a prayer session. And all of us surrounded this little guy, which I don't say in any demeaning way. He is small of stature and great of courage and of faith. And the prayers kind of came spontaneously. And eventually the prayers began to be prayers of asking for God's blessing on this Moses as he went to the courts of Pharaoh. And that kind of hits down deep. This was the president of my country, who was the Pharaoh, who was held responsible, and I think in many ways rightly, for the suppression of more than 20 million people. And a beautiful feeling, a beautiful expression of gathering around him as he went the next day to this meeting. A somewhat similar experience of knowing the sense in which people hold the United States partially accountable for the situation that came in Namibia, also known as Southwest Africa, and in South Africa, the government which has ruled Namibia since 1915, since World War I, calls it Southwest, or the territory, or in other terms, but the African name, which the Africans use, is Namibia. It was in a church there, in the black section of Windhoek, the capital, or just outside of Windhoek, in a place called Katatura, which, as I was told, means something like the place no one wants. I'm not good at numbers of crowds, but I suppose there was 900 or 1,000 people worshiping there. In the situation of Southern Africa, it often amazes me of the miraculous continuing of the Christian church, where Christianity has, in Southern Africa, come through white missionaries or through the white churches, and the suffering that people have been subjected to, that they stay with Christ. Of course, Christ stays with them, one would have to say and see, but it's still amazing the vitality of the church. And I was asked to give a greeting. Our executive director said there's several characteristics that an area secretary working for the division always have to fulfill. One is that you can sleep on any bed, and two, that you can eat any food, and three, that you can preach on 3-minute notice. And this often takes place, so visit places, you get invited on the spot to preach or to give a greeting means more than to say hello. And tried in a way to express the solidarity of people of this country with the people of that country. And the pastor, after I'd spoken, thanked me graciously in good African style, and then said also, would you kindly go home and gather the Christians of your country and make changes in the policy of your country which is keeping us in bondage. Perhaps, you know, unknowing that Christians in this country are not that easily united in the first place, and that there are as many Christians in this country, particularly those that come out of many of the right-wing groups of Christians in this country through many of the media preachers, who are very much in tune with supporting the government policy of our relationship to Southern Africa. And yet that was the request to me, to go home, to mobilize the Christians who, understanding and being in Christ, surely would gather and mount all the power that we have to give and to go and demand of our government changes that are keeping them from freedom, which has been declared by the United Nations. South Africa has been asked how many times, by how many resolutions, including Resolution 435, to guarantee the immediate independence of Namibia as an independent country. Apartheid as a system, I suppose, is something that people could argue about, and certainly people in South Africa argue about it as a system. It is, in a way, a philosophy of separate development. It's certainly not separate and equal, although that's often claimed. It has within it a lot of theological presuppositions. But the separateness of races and of peoples is within the will of God. That has created a great deal of discussion within church circles, in which such a position, the apartheid system of South Africa, has been declared a heresy. It has, by the World Alliance of Reformed Churches, 1982, and then elected Alan Bosak, a colored, which is mixed race, South African, as its president. So in a sense, Alan Bosak is the spiritual leader of the prime minister, or now the state president, according to their changes of structure. But the spiritual leader of the prime minister can't go and take communion in the prime minister's church because of the separation of churches according to the racial lines. Desmond Tutu called that an example of God's humor. How someone can have the spirituality to face that situation and call it an example of God's humor is, to me, a gift of grace, that can be a perspective. Basically, I think we need to see that apartheid is people. It's people who are separated, people who are denied, people who are imprisoned, people who are detained, people who are killed in prison and police station interrogations. It's people who are tortured. That's really what apartheid is people and the effect of the system on people. The present situation in South Africa is extremely tense. And people sometimes weary of hearing that, because we've heard it since 1961, that it's a tinderbox ready to explode, and somehow it never explodes. And people say, when is the violence going to come? Well, the violence has certainly come. And the violence is there all the time. And the violence is daily meted out to people. You can't forcably remove 3.5 million people from their homes and there not be violence. The only thing is that the violence, in a counter-violence, has not yet reached very much of a proportion. When it comes in just little bits, the police and the secret police and the army are called in to immediately put down the situation, which is what's happening now. The emergency measures have been declared in the last year. Up to this point, 500 people have been killed, many of them, again, youth and children and people involved in marches at funerals, which up until last week was the only place where black people could gather in any numbers other than normal Sunday worship services. All other meetings, organizations, planning, labor unions, all functions were banned. And now additional measures have been put into the emergency measures that limit the number of burials at one time to one person, and only clergy persons are allowed to speak. There was, because of this boiling pot, the gathering of people at funerals became demonstrations, the only place where they could happen. And as much as 20,000 people gathered at funerals for five or six young persons killed by the police. The pot is indeed boiling, and many people say much more so than in the other events, which we know as the Sharpeville Massacre and the Soweto Uprising and previous years. And other factors seem to be taking place that make it more ominous. For one thing, leaders like Alan Bosak and Desmond Tutu within the churches have a very limited time, perhaps physically, you know, their lives, but they also have a very limited time in which they are listened to. The black people, especially the younger people, find them increasingly to be collaborators with the government because they want peace, they want nonviolent means. And the people that are being killed in the riots are black people that other blacks have thought to be collaborators with the government. The political leaders of the homelands who have bought in and are repaid, the buffer elite of blacks that are developed by the white system so they can be a kind of a show-off, a show piece for the Chamber of Commerce and Barclays Bank and others who have sent delegations to this country of black people who are in this thin veneer of middle class. It is these people that are being attacked in the riots. The riots have not as yet reached into the white areas. Very few examples of sabotage, of bombing, of installations of white people. And one could look at the situation, if there really were retaliation and vengeance and hatred within the hearts of the black people of South Africa, you know, what they could do. Every white child is raised by a black nanny, virtually. The daily contact is with a black woman. Almost all the food of white people is prepared. I mean, how much does it take to poison people? If there really were revenge and hatred in people, if there really were retaliation in the minds and the spirits of the people, all the restaurant food, all the services are provided. But that is not the mentality. I think that's a miracle. And it's an evidence of the grace of God and of the spirituality of the black people within that situation, which is, to me, far greater than one could expect, and certainly far greater than I think I would have in that situation. I cannot imagine myself standing up and saying, after suffering those indignities for generations, and saying, we love you. It is not our desire to push you into the sea. Even though blacks outnumber whites 5-1 and have no rights, no citizenship, no possibility of owning land, no vote. And then to say, we love you. That to me is incredible. And whether or not that voice, that spirituality can be maintained is really questionable, because the militancy of others is rising very quickly, who don't see the nonviolent means as having produced any result. That's why people look at the U.S. policy of constructive engagement, which is going on for these last number of years, and saying it certainly hasn't worked because the situation is worse. And we can look at other ways in which people look at us and our complicity in that. The church, in many ways, is involved in the struggle, as I began. And I would just like to hold up two aspects in which church people within that situation are asking of us assistance. And the first is to declare apartheid and any other evidences of racism a sin. We have a lot to do in this country in regard to that sin. I mean, one can't look at the United States history with a great deal of pride in relation to black people and to the American Native Indians. And to continue within our churches in worship, in prayers, in publications, and holding before people that racism and all of its expressions, including apartheid, is a sin. The Dutch Reformed Church of South Africa, which people have facetiously called the Nationalist Party at prayer, also says that racism is a sin and is opposed to racism, but to them apartheid is not racist. It's separate development. I think it's ways that we have to look at our own selves in that same light. We can easily say racism is a sin, and in many cases to say it is easier than to do it, but when to do it is better than to say it, and in most cases more needed. We don't have time at this point, and maybe some could help get into the sea where there are real theological roots to the system of apartheid. Part of it is economic, to work in the mines when gold and silver and diamonds were discovered. There was a labor force. A lot of it had to do within the conflict of the Afrikaners and the British in Southern Africa fighting for the land, almost disregarding all of the rest of the people in the country who were non-European, and the struggles of the Afrikaners in their trek north, the Boer trekkers, the Boers, and trying to find a new place, a new land. And went with their scripture and their somewhat puritanical views toward life, and found some identity with Israel and the trek to find a promised land and all of these. There are so many intricacies of the religious faith of people and the maintenance of a system. Today the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa does a great deal for black people. It just, you know, it doesn't let them into, I mean, it has separate churches. There are colored Reformed churches and black Reformed churches and of course the white church, which is dominant, and you don't go to communion or worship in different ones, but there are other expressions of, you know, what we would call charitable work. And yet the core of it is that on religious grounds and religious justification, or at least biblical or theological, that the system is maintained, as well as from economic reasons. I think that's one thing that they ask of us, is to continue to hold within our churches, within our communities of faith, every evidence where racism is known, and to call a sin a sin. And I think, secondly, they would, as the pastor in Kataturra in Namibia asked me, to work for changes within our country's policy. to declare, as the South African Council of Churches leaders do, that constructive engagement is a total disaster and has worked only for destruction and destabilization of neighboring countries. That is really one of the effective parts of constructive engagement is that all the neighboring countries of South Africa have been destabilized, which gives some semblance of stability to South Africa, because neighbors that might have given trouble and given haven to the African National Congress and other liberation movements are less able to do that. So we have effectively destabilized neighboring countries. That's part of our insistence that we don't push the Namibian independence issue until the Cubans get out of Angola. I mean, that's like saying we can't give freedom to Mexico until the French leave Canada or something. To the Namibians, the two are totally unrelated and make no sense. But we have related them in a common thread of getting caught up in a kind of anti-communist hysteria. And we found within South Africa all the rhetoric of anti-communism, which fits so well into this country. Anyone that opposes the government in South Africa as part of the emergency measures in the Anti-Terrorism Act and the Anti-Communist Act can be imprisoned without notification of family, without charge, and be detained for who knows how long. And estimated that the numbers are well into the thousands in these last couple of weeks, people so detained. There are some pieces of literature around the stones here and in our meeting, which can be helpful in getting some specific handles on where we can be effective, from Lutheran World Ministries, from the National Council of Churches, from the Washington Office on Africa. There is a few copies of a packet here, which you're free to come and use and look through, which outlines many of the things related to present advocacy and education efforts on the part of churches and other organizations in this country seeking to effect change for people in South Africa. The question that often gets asked is I suppose the important one is there any hope? Sometimes it's difficult for us whose psyche is developed by a culture that looks at progress to see in that situation progress. And yet I would have to hold as a primary reason for hope at this point is the tremendous spirituality and the patience of the black people. In other places in Africa where the colonial rule has ended, and there have been many instances of blacks continuing to keep within their structures the former colonial leaders. And I frankly can't imagine that happening as readily within our own system if the things were turned around. It's true that Ian Smith in Zimbabwe is not all that well liked by Robert Mugabe, but he's still in the government. Can you imagine years and years of civil war and fighting against this enemy, this person that was looked at by the black freedom fighters as the cruel white person who had declared that never in 1,000 years will Rhodesia be black ruled. And today he's in the government, under a black-ruled nation. people are quick to say Zimbabwe can't rule itself, see the blacks can't do this or that. I think that we can look at some remarkable changes that have taken place and look at it as a remarkable example of what can happen. I think another reason for hope is that somewhere down the line, South Africa will recognize the tremendous economic cost of apartheid. There's benefits economically to a cheap labor force, as we know by looking at the labels of our clothing and how much comes from Taiwan and Korea and other places where there's cheap labor. But there's also cost to the government. For example, maintaining 14 ministers of education, because you have a minister of education for every homeland and a minister of education for every racial group, and that takes money. You have this increasing bureaucracy of government to maintain a separate development. I think another reason for hope is the continued international pressure of churches. I think people like Bishop Tutu and Alan Bosak and Byers and O'Day and other people would not be alive, perhaps, certainly free, if it were not for the international pressure of organizations such as churches. I think we need to maintain that sense of solidarity as Christians with those people in the struggle. I think increasingly another reason for hope, in a kind of negative way, is that increasingly there are a lot of organizations, including religious ones in this country, that is becoming clear of their South African connections. That a lot of South African money is funding a lot of things in this country which perpetuate a kind of political climate and mood which is advantageous to their interests and to the maintaining of the connection of our government and industry with theirs. And some of those are surfacing, and yet they have all the money. It's hard to counteract something glossy and printed with all kinds of documentation with a small budget and a mimeograph machine. But increasingly those connections are being uncovered. And I think another hope is a concern of individual Christians in this country who will continue to express to the world, to our government, to our neighbors, to our families, our principal belief that economic gain is less important than human values. And that's, again, easy to say. But I believe that our continuing involvement in Southern South Africa is a political identity, but it's principally an economic one. And human rights become second or third, or at least less than primary, in relationships that it sees economic growth and progress becoming number one as a principle and ongoing energizing force in our society. And I think a hope lies that increasingly more people in this land will see and express that conviction that human values are more important than economic gain. Let me stop there and open for questions and comments that people around the room have.
Develop, would you, for a little further, your thought of Reagan as Pharaoh?
I don't know, as though it were, it was not my thought in the beginning, but I increasingly came to believe it and have come
I
to believe
that.
It. And I think that from black South Africans, church people who have expressed themselves in relationship to our country, have said that there are two people who have the most power in this world to maintain the system of apartheid and the prevention of independence for Namibia, and that's P.W. Botha and Ronald Reagan. And they see the connection of this, the most powerful economic country in the world, and the president then being the leader, and in a sense, the ideological formulator for policy of this country as it's expressed to the world, in league. And that we continue, by this policy and by this support, to buttress the South African government and system. And South Africa is not the kingdom of that pharaoh, but in worldwide sense, they would look at least a cousin of their pharaoh, the prime minister. And I think that we allow to happen to black South Africans what we would never allow to happen anywhere else in the world. I mean, why do we put embargoes and sanctions on Nicaragua and we don't on South Africa? Why do we continue to supply strategic items to build up and enhance their military machinery of South Africa by providing computers and technological advancements and give absolutely no support to those fighting for and working for, in a peaceful way, freedom?
Isn't the answer to your question economics?
And my answer to that answer is that if we really believe in the value of human rights above economics, that we would act that way. We didn't act that way in Poland. We acted quickly. In other parts of the world, if there were a similar kind of movement of people taking over the lives and the human rights of others, we would act quickly. But we don't in South Africa. We in fact work the other way. We support those who maintain the prisons rather than give help to the prisoners.
You mean Poland only a few years ago or Poland back in the 30s? What Poland are you referring to?
When there were the efforts of the Soviet Union to put down Solidarity, and you know, we immediately take action against this because this foreign power, this other power, was suppressing people. But the suppression goes on forever and ever in South Africa, and we don't act. Probably not, but it was a poor example. But at least there was a lot of national attention and talk of sanctions and boycotts. Yeah.
What about the slowness of our own LCA to respond to calls for divestment? Did we not pass resolution for divestment through LCA convention, and then that's been blocked within our own structures?
It has been slow. It has been blocked. There has been some movement, but to me it has not been as much or as significant as it should be. For one thing, the Board of Pensions of the LCA is chartered in such a way that it acts independently. And the church cannot tell the Board of Pensions how to invest its money, and prudent investment is maintained, that in terms, you know, that one, that, in other words, so that kind of takes that out. There has been divestment in several instances. There have been shareholder action at annual meetings of corporations. There has been dialogue between leaders of corporations and the church, leaders in various ways. That has taken place. There's been a network developed, not only of funds and organizations, which the LCA really doesn't have all that much money invested, other than Board of Pensions. Mm-hmm. But it's established a network, for example, of church colleges and seminaries, of synods, of social service institutions, of other related institutions within the church that may have investments. You know, it's an action, and there has been action taken, but in a kind of movement totally, it has not moved as quickly as apparently you would like or I would have liked.
I find the Board of Pensions particularly to just be an incredible situation where nobody seems to have control of that.
Can the pensioners impact
that? I'm a pensioner. I don't seem to have much impact on that.
It has, you know, the board is elected by the church, so it is governed by its board, and that is where it is. Yes.
Yeah, but there are many members of the LCA Church in America that support the president's feelings on South Africa, aren't there?
Certainly.
And of course, we haven't had a raise of hands, you know, of all the people in the LCA or the ALC. Find out how many go with the president on this and how many don't. So, no surprise that things move slowly then.
No, it's no surprise. It's not very heartening, but it certainly is true that, you know, you would find across the church, I suppose, just as you would in the Dutch Reformed Church of South Africa, people saying racism is wrong. But when you get it down to cases and specific things like our present policy, or as they would in their country, in South Africa, this is, you know, they always talk about, well, you have to understand the situation and the history and all of this. And it's at this point, and I think within a lot of people of the churches that get really caught on the fact of South Africa being anti-communist, and have been strongly so, you know, since the beginning of this present regime and before that. And a lot of the movements within South Africa now are very similar to Nazi ideology of Germany. In fact, one of the new organizations, the right wing in South Africa, has a symbol that looks almost like the swastika, and there's that kind of buildup, which is so strongly anti-communist, which immediately hooks people here. You have black people in South Africa saying, "Well, what is the fear of communism?" Well, it's a system that will set up dictatorial powers, will take away human rights. You will not have freedom of ownership of land, everything will be national. That's what we have. And it's you know, certainly no wonder that they don't get so upset about the Marxism communism issue. Because at this point they could say, look what we have out of a government that has Christianity and its constitution as being a Christian state. Could we expect any worse out of some other kind of system? Yes.
When you talk to black leaders down there, what do they think about the idea of disinvestment or divestment, is that the word? Do they think that's something effective for us to do?
If they can't,
they free to
I think I mentioned Alan Bosak speaking in Virginia a couple of weeks ago at our mission event, and he said things about divestment that I thought were very courageous, probably dangerous, foolish, because it is a treasonable offense to advocate divestment or disinvestment in South Africa. So publicly they can say very little. But everyone that you hear speaking against divestment are people in power. The people employed, for example, who are black, are less than 1% of the black working force of South Africa. And then they talk about if U.S. divests, all these masses of blacks will be out of work.
Yeah.
It's 8/10 of 1% that are employed by U.S.-related corporations.